I got a fever, and the only prescription is more Patrick Madrid. Come on.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Sad story to report to you. Kind of a weird story, too. This took place in Michigan. Gregory Jarvis, 57 years old. He won a $45,000 lottery game prize, but he drowned with the ticket in his wallet before he was able to cash it. It's just a strange, sad story. They said he was a very nice guy. He would come into the Blue Water Inn in Caseville, Michigan. That's where he played club keno, and he hit the jackpot. And his lottery game prize was $45,000, but he couldn't redeem it. He couldn't cash it because he didn't have a valid Social Security card. So the night that he won the money, he bought drinks all around for the house, or on the house. No, on him, I should say. But he couldn't cash the lottery game ticket because he needed a valid Social Security card. So he reapplied for a Social Security card. And then after a few days, he didn't show up, and they thought maybe he was out working somewhere. But eventually, his body had been found in, I guess it was a lake near a boat. And it looks as though when they did the autopsy that he fell out of his boat, hit his head, and drowned. Very sad. May he rest in peace. So he was waiting to get his Social Security card when this happened. So they've given that money to his relatives. And that's the whole story. It's just, I guess it just goes to show that you always need to be ready. Always be prepared to meet Jesus and have your exit interview. And I have no earthly idea what his life was like in that regard. But when I saw the headline, it reminded me once again about how unpredictable life can be. So maybe the takeaway for you on that one is if it's been a long time since you've been to confession, go to confession. You know, get right with God. And if you find yourself falling into sin, serious sin, get back out of it. Because you never know. You're riding high one day with $45,000 in your pocket, almost. At least you've got the the certificate that will give you that money. The next thing you know, you may be having your exit interview. So something to think about. Let's go to Rose now in Chula Vista, California. Hi, Rose.
Hi, Patrick. I have a question.
Okay.
This was texted to me yesterday by my daughter. She said, is it true if someone was cremated before the funeral, the church, the Catholic Church, will not allow a Catholic Mass?
I don't think that's true. I don't know with certitude. I'd have to check the U.S. Bishop's website. You could check that, too. It's usccb.org. But I don't believe that's true.
Oh, okay. Because I told her, after I came up with a few suggestions, I finally told her, I'm going to call Patrick Madrid, and I want you to listen to his program tomorrow. So I'm getting her to listen to Relevant Radio, because you have a lot of knowledge, and she comes up with some questions, and I don't have all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
So if I go to the CCCB.
Yeah, so it's
website,
U.S. I'll tell you the URL. It's usccb.org.
Okay.
That stands for U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. So usccb.org. And there's a search bar near the top. If you just type in cremation or Mass of Christian Burial, you'll pull up whatever articles that they have on those topics. That's typically how I research it if I don't know the answer to that. But my sense is...
Oh, good.
And I'm more than willing to be corrected if I'm mistaken on this, but my sense is that in a situation where cremation was necessary or it just happened before the Mass was able to be celebrated, the church would not say no. I'm thinking, for example, let's say that there was an outbreak of cholera or some other devastating plague, and it was let's say for sanitary purposes, it was necessary to cremate bodies. Well, the church is not going to say, well, I'm sorry, there's no Mass of Christian Burial for the repose of the soul because the cremation took place before the funeral. So again, I don't think I'm wrong on this, but it's always good to check on the bishop's website, okay?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I told her to call the parish priest, and he might probably send her to the same place.
Perhaps so. Yeah, perhaps so.
Okay.
I don't advocate cremation, by the way.
No.
I know it's becoming very popular, but for me, and I'm just sharing my own opinion because keep in mind the church does permit it now. It didn't used to, But the church does permit cremation now. But I'm opposed to it primarily on the grounds of I recoil at the thought of destroying the body with fire. So to destroy the body, which is what cremation does, to me it just seems inconsistent with the body being the temple of the Holy Spirit for a baptized person. So on those grounds, I myself do not recommend cremation, but I have no say in the matter because the church permits it. So people are free to do as they wish on that particular point.
Is there anything, would the website also tell us about keeping the ashes and not having them buried?
Yes. In fact, that I can tell you, because I've quoted it from the U.S. Bishop's website before. The church does not permit that you can keep the remains, so that, say, the ashes, in an urn in your home. You're not supposed to scatter the ashes anywhere. Rather, the church says that they should be interred either in a columbarium, which is a place for urns, or a columbarium will be found in a Catholic cemetery, or in some sort of a cemetery setting, a crypt, a mausoleum, and preferably Catholic, so that people can pay their respects and show the proper care for the remains of what once was the Temple of the Holy Spirit. And that is specified in detail on the bishop's website. Hope that's helpful to you, Rose. Thank you. What I'd like to do now is just take a couple of minutes and talk a little bit about the proofs for the existence of God that St. Thomas Aquinas developed. Now, he developed it in, you might say, kind of in concert with one of the ancient Greek philosophers, Aristotle, who in his own way and without the benefit of divine revelation, he came very close to the issue of the existence of God without knowing God himself. He was not Jewish, obviously. It was long before Christianity. So he didn't have the benefit of divine revelation. So just on the basis of his sheer intellectual inquiry, he was able to put together a series of proofs as he saw them for the existence of God. And it might be worthwhile to go through that so that we can consider how you might talk about the existence of God. So in no particular order. Now, in some scenarios or some settings, you might find them presented in a particular order. But let's just talk about them in no particular order. So the first one that I'll discuss anyway is the argument from motion. Now, motion can be understood in a couple of ways. One is the motion of an object through space. So locomotion, an object moving through space from point A to point B. We recognize this because we live it all the time. You're always moving. And all of the component parts of your body are always moving, even down to the submolecular level. There's motion going on. You'll notice that when a person dies, and it doesn't even just have to be a person, it could be a dog, could be a plant, could be a tree. You take any living being that dies and the life principle goes out of it. What do you notice? You notice, first of all, it stops moving. Not only does the animal itself, you know, Rover, he stops running around, wagging his tail and such, and he's now motionless. Because why? Because he's dead. But if you were to look deeper into the physical structure of the dog or any living thing for that matter, you'll notice that all the component parts of that thing also stop moving. So the molecules are no longer moving. The atoms, the electrons, the neutrons, all those things that are moving constantly in the body cease. So the movement stops. This is movement, locomotion from point A to point B. So from that, we can discern that there's something going on here, that there is an animating principle that causes Rover to wag his tail and to run around and bark and to move as dogs do. And without that animating principle, he no longer does it because he's now dead. The same is true for the electrons, the atoms, and all those parts of the body that are moving. There's something that was making them move, and that thing is now gone, therefore it no longer moves. So we experience this constantly in the form of death, the death of things. So one thing we can learn from that is that things move because something makes them move. Something is causing those component parts in your body to move, to vibrate, to oscillate. There's something that's making it move. Now, in the case of a human being, this is true of animals, but in a lesser sense, because we have as human beings a rational soul, it's our soul that's animating the body. This is why philosophers point out that the soul is the form of the body. The soul is the organizing principle. Your soul is what organizes your body. It's what animates your organs. It's what makes your heart beat. It's what makes all of those things move. And if the soul separates from the body, you die and everything stops moving. So the key here is to realize that there's something required that's outside of the things that are moving to make them move. Another example, let's say you and your buddies, you want to play some billiards and you go into the billiard room and you rack up the balls and you're chalking your pool sticks. And before anyone had a chance to hit the cue ball to break up the other balls that had just been racked up, what if all of a sudden all the balls on the billiard table started moving on their own? You would immediately, without hesitation, you would immediately be thinking, why are these balls moving and what's the cause of it? Is there an earthquake? Is there a wind? Is the house tilting on its foundation? Because there would have to be some cause that would make those billiard balls move from their stationary place. And if there wasn't a cause, if there was no wind, and there's no earthquake, and the house is not tilting on its foundation, and nobody bumped the table, and there's no other external cause for those billiard balls to be moving around on the table, I'm pretty confident you would probably get out of that room very quickly because you'd think, is this haunted? What's going on here? It would be frightening if you saw billiard balls moving on their own accord on a billiard table. This is one of those odd things about life. You notice how we're frightened by things that should move but don't, like, you know, a dead body. And we're also frightened by things that shouldn't move and do. So St. Thomas was pointing out merely that all around us we see motion taking place constantly, and we recognize instinctively that things that are in motion are set in motion by something else. Okay. The other part of motion and the argument from motion or is change. Now, change is a type of motion in itself. It's a movement from what we can think of as potentiality to act. And all that really means is that things have the potential to be different from how they are. They could be different, and often they become different. Well, I shouldn't say often. Constantly, everything is becoming different. You're getting older. Things get bigger. Things get smaller. Things get broken. An acorn that you fling into the forest, you come back 30 years later, there's an oak tree. So it changed. So there's this constant change that's going on. Things are moving from what we consider potency or the potentiality to become something. They're moving to what they can become. So this Dixie cup, this white styrofoam Dixie cup full of water, which is imaginary because I don't have one with me, but let's say I do. It's full of water right now. It could be empty, but it's not because it's full. But if I tip it over and pour out all the water, it's now empty. So that cup had the potential to be empty. It wasn't, but then it became empty. So that's a movement in terms of change, things getting older, etc. And the same phenomenon is explained in the same way. So things that change don't change unless there's a change agent that causes the change, something external to it that causes it to change. And if there is no external agent, if I were not holding the cup in my hand and saying, well, it could be emptied, and then turn my hand upside down to empty the cup, it would not be emptied. It would stay full.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So with that in mind, let's consider then this universe that we inhabit, not just our bodies, but also this planet and the galaxy and the universe itself and everything in it. Everything is in motion. Not only is it in locomotion, but it's also changing. The universe is expanding. Things are getting older. Things break. Things are destroyed. They come into and out of existence. So we have all this motion, and it can't be explained on its own basis. In other words, the things that are moving are moved by other things, but ultimately all of this movement that began, I guess, with the Big Bang and all of this motion outward started at a certain point eons ago, that had to have a cause because nothing is moving that isn't set in motion by something else, as we've already proposed. So the prime mover, who is itself not moved by anything else, but is necessary in order to start the process going, that being we call God. Quick example of what I'm talking about. You see a train go by, and at the very end of the train, you see the caboose. Now, you know the caboose is being, you can see it, it's moving right in front of you, but you know that the only way it can move is by being pulled by the car that it's hitched to, the car in front of it. But you know that that car is only moving because it's hitched to the car in front of it, and so on and so forth, and it doesn't matter how long this train is. This train could be 10 cars long. This train can be a trillion, trillion, trillion cars long. Doesn't matter. All that we know is that at the very front of this train, however long it might be, there must be an engine that is pulling it, because if there's no engine that is not being moved by something else but is pulling everything else, then none of those cars can move. And yet you see them all moving. So basic logic shows us that there must be some agent that set this motion into process, otherwise none of these things could move. So again, this being, or this cause, we could say, that causes all the motion and the change, we call God. So that's one example. Another example would be called causality, or efficient causality, which is a more appropriate term for it. In other words, it affects the cause. You know, we think about cause and effect. Efficient causality is simply a way of saying that nothing comes into existence on its own. Nothing comes into existence by itself. It's brought into existence. You were brought into existence. So in your body, that was the result of the physical union of your parents. Had that not happened, you wouldn't be here. God created your soul, but your parents together created your body. The microphone I'm speaking into right now in this studio, it was created in a manufacturing plant somewhere. It was created in the mind of the person who designed it. It was created at the factory where the parts were assembled, and it was turned into a functioning microphone. It didn't just come into existence on its own. Nothing comes into existence on its own. Nothing can give itself existence, in other words. Being is something that you receive. So whether it's your body or your house or this planet or this galaxy or even the universe itself, everything we can see is caused by something outside of it and before it. This is why it's completely illogical to say that the universe is eternal. That's an impossibility, logically speaking, rationally speaking, because we have evidence all around us, without exception, that things that come into existence are brought into existence by something else. So the universe can't just be here forever and ever. Something had to cause it. We call that cause the first cause. We call that God. Because without God, none of these other things could have happened. They could not have come into existence. Now, who created God? That's kind of a dumb question, but sometimes you hear people say that. Nobody created God. By definition, God is the first cause, and he's the uncaused cause. Nobody created God. He has always existed. And if he didn't always exist, nothing could exist. If there wasn't some pre-existent and eternally existent thing, being, entity, whatever term you'd like to use, I call him God, but use whatever term you prefer, then nothing could exist. But yet things do exist, and they're brought into existence by previous causes. That had to begin somewhere. So if you walk into a room and you hear piano music and you see that, there's a lady at the piano and she's playing the music, the reason you hear the music is because she's playing the piano. And if she were to take a break and get up and walk away from the piano, the music stops. Why does it stop? Because she's no longer causing it to be there. It's there because she caused it. If she's not doing what's necessary to cause the music stops. Or it doesn't start in the first place. So there we have the first two, motion and causality. Now let's talk about what's called contingency. Now, contingency doesn't mean like, you know, what's your contingency plan? If this doesn't work out, it doesn't mean contingency in that sense. Contingency in this context refers to necessity, or as the case may be, a lack of necessity. And what we mean by this is that things exist, we see them, but we know that they're not necessary to exist because at one time they didn't exist. So you yourself are not absolutely necessary to exist, and the easiest proof is that however long it was ago that you were born, you go back a second, well, not born, but let's say conceived, you go back a second, a day, a week, a month before that, you didn't exist. So at one time, you were not here, and yet you are here, and this planet is here, and this solar system and galaxy, indeed, the universe itself is here. But none of these things need to be here because at one time they didn't exist. Going back to the Big Bang again for a second, we're still wondering what banged. We don't know yet. I have a pretty good idea. I would say that's God who spoke things into existence. But in any case, science will catch up with that in due time. In the meantime, if we just consider this scientifically and rationally, we see that we have this entire universe filled with contingent, i.e. unnecessary beings, things that exist. And they didn't have to exist because at one time they didn't exist, and yet they do exist. So how did this all start? Well, that must require, it's an inevitable conclusion here, it must require something that necessarily exists, that must exist in order for anything else to exist. And if this first necessary being didn't exist, nothing could exist. I hope you follow the logic here. And so this is what St. Paul's referring to in Romans when he talks about that nobody has an excuse to not believe in God. All you have to do is look around. Look at the cosmos, and you see, even at an elementary sort of rational 2 and 2 equals 4 sort of process, you can see that we have all these things that don't need to be here, but they are here. There must be something that must exist in order for any of these things to exist. Then let's talk about degrees of perfection. Now, degrees of perfection is, you know, it's a subtle way of looking at this, but it's a way of considering that in this life we recognize that some things tend toward perfection and other things tend away from perfection. So, you know, a line that's not quite straight, you know it's not quite straight because you know what a straight line is. You can compare it to a perfectly straight line or a perfectly round circle. Now, we recognize this not just in objects, but we recognize it in other things, like things are hotter, things are cooler, things are better, things are worse. So our whole existence is bound up in recognizing things on a spectrum of degree or spectrum of gradation, tending toward our ideal of the perfect and tending away from it. So St. Thomas, building upon what Aristotle had to say, he's simply pointing out that that would be impossible in an ultimate sense if there was not some ultimate standard of good, some ultimate standard of perfection. Everything would be purely relative and subjective. So this is one of those arguments for the existence of God that points to all around us we see these degrees of perfection. But in order for that to have any real meaning or intelligibility, there must be some ultimate standard of perfection by which things are ultimately measured. And then lastly, this harkens back to the discussion we had a few minutes ago, and this has to do with design. And I won't belabor this point because we already talked about it, but it's simply to say that as you consider the physical universe, the cosmos, you see a vast orderly system that's governed by laws. You might ask, why isn't everything just chaos? Why are things governed by laws? Where do these laws come from? Why is it that chemical molecules, in chemistry, they bind in a certain way, or they repel each other in a certain way? They produce certain reactions when you combine certain molecular combinations. Why is that? Why is it always that way? Why are these laws seemingly immutable throughout the universe? Now, we don't have to get into Einstein and his theory of relativity and those kinds of things. That's a little deeper water than we're able to go into on a radio program. But nonetheless, we see all around us this very, you might say, constant set of rules that suggest design. We talked about the various things in the universe that are so fine-tuned that if you were to go a slight degree or a fraction of a degree in one way or the other, life couldn't exist. And yet it does exist. And the complexity of DNA and how it is a code, its information in a precise sequence, all of these things, of course, point to a designer. So there's a lot that we could say about all five of these different ways of looking at the existence of God. They're not proofs in a strict sense, but I would say they're strong arguments that point inexorably, in my view, toward the existence of God. Now, you'll notice I never quoted the Bible. I never invoked Jesus Christ. One could do those things, but if you're talking to a secular person who doesn't believe in those things anyway, that's not going to do you much good. So my advice would be to master these basic concepts so that you can bring them up in a conversation and then maybe ask your atheist friend, well, how do you explain it? If God doesn't exist, how do you explain this? That would lead to a very interesting conversation, if you ask me. I'm looking forward to a conversation with you when we return. My number is 888-914-9149.
For more of The Patrick Madrid Show, visit relevantradio.com/Patrick.
This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at avemariafunds.com.
This is The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Cyrus, I'll bet with a very high degree of accuracy that I bet I can guess how many times you checked your smartphone yesterday.
Uh-oh.
Want to take me up on it?
No, that makes me nervous.
Well, if you're like most Americans...
I was just checking it when you said that.
Yeah. Well, you're proving the point of this article then. This is from Fox 5 New York. New research shows the U.S. is deep into the digital age, and data showing Americans check their phones 96 times a day.
Whew.
Yeah. It sounds terrible when you put it that way, right? That's once every 10 minutes, according to global tech care company Asurion. The company also said it's a 20% increase from a similar survey that they did 2 years ago. Asurion says that 50% of Americans are attempting to use their phones less. The company's data also showed 18 to 24-year-olds check their phones twice as much as the national average, and that age group is aware of their heavy phone usage. So they're aware of it, but they do it anyway. Other key findings from the survey include that staying connected with family and friends is the number one reason people use their phones. Texting is now common among all age groups, with baby boomers being 7 times more likely to text than to talk in person, and twice as likely to send a text rather than dial a phone number. I think I'm guilty as charged. I do that. I find texting so much more convenient because I'm not going to interrupt whatever the person is doing. They can read the text when they get to it. I think I in a way prefer getting texts to getting phone calls now, honestly.
You ever text somebody that's in your house? They're just,
yes.
You know, I have too. Guilty.
Yeah. It sounds ludicrous, though, doesn't it?
It does. Oh, yeah. It's silly.
The survey showed nearly nine out of 10 Americans are offended when someone they're speaking with starts looking at their phone. Ironically, 75% of survey takers admit that they've done it themselves, and nearly 1 in 5 say they do it frequently. What? What was that? Funky facts. Okay.
Yeah, you're giving us some funky facts.
Yeah, that's from the 70s, I guess. Researchers show that smartphone use triggers dopamine, the neurotransmitter responsible for the brain's reward and pleasure zones, the same chemical released while eating and some studies show while playing video games. The neurotransmitter has been tied to addiction, but knowing whether you have developed an unhealthy dependence on your smartphone depends on you and your loved one's feelings. So...
Yes, that's true.
And the show just wouldn't be the same if I didn't share this story quickly before we go to the phones. You'll love this one, Cyrus. It's a sad story. I'm sorry to say so, but a man in northeastern Illinois died from rabies. He got rabies because he woke up. He was asleep in his room, and he woke up, and there was a bat on his neck. What's this bat doing on my neck? He probably said when he... jumped out of bed. And indeed, he had been bitten by the bat, and the bat tested positive for rabies. And the man died of rabies because, not because he necessarily had to die of it, but because he refused treatment. Uh-huh. So about a month after being bitten by the bat, he started suffering from neck pain, headache, numbness in his fingers, difficulty controlling his arms, and trouble speaking. They confirmed that the man died, they being the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, confirmed that he died of rabies. One of the physicians at the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, says rabies has the highest mortality rate of any disease. I did not know that. Rabies has the highest mortality rate of any disease. However, there is life-saving treatment for people who quickly seek care after being exposed to animals with rabies. The rabies virus is transmitted through direct contact with an infected animal, including through the saliva or brain or the nervous system tissue. The rabies virus attacks the central nervous system, causing a brain disease that can lead to death without treatment. Human rabies infections are rare in the U.S., with 1 to 3 cases reported each year. Still, an estimated 60,000 Americans receive the post-exposure vaccination series each year. Illinois public health officials caution that even though people are usually aware that they have been bitten by a bat because they have very small teeth, the bite mark may not be easy to see. I'm still thinking about the guy waking up with a bat attached to his neck. That's the part that really gets me about this poor man. The state health department advises people who come in close contact to a bat should not release it until it can be tested for rabies. People are also encouraged to contact local health officials to find out whether or not they have been exposed to rabies. 2019 CDC report found that bats are the cause of 7 out of 10 cases of rabies in the United States. You used to think about rabid dogs, and they have a stat on that too. They say that rabies trends in the United States over the last 80 years show that most infections came before from dog bites. But then in 1960, when wildlife species, especially bats, primarily the source for human infection, they then became the predominant means or vector, I guess, for getting rabies for humans. Used to be the dogs. And now the dogs get shots, I guess, so they don't have the rabies so much. True story, Cyrus. Real quick, I want to tell you the story. So I was speaking in Marion, Iowa, a suburb or a near suburb. I guess it's not a suburb, but it's not far from Dubuque. And after the event was over, we're up in the rectory. It's kind of an old, big rectory. And I'm up there with a couple of priests and we're having a beer and just enjoying, you know, being done for the day. And all of a sudden, this big bat starts flying around in this room. It's like the, you know, the recreation room in the rectory. And I was terrified because this thing was like, it felt to me like it was the size of a seagull. It probably wasn't, but it was just swooping and diving. And I didn't want to get bitten by that thing. So one of the priests, he just very calmly stands up. He goes to the closet. He gets out a tennis racket, and then within a matter of a minute or so, he had hit this bat out of the air, and I don't know what they wound up doing with the bat, but he was no longer flying in that room, and I felt good about that. So keep a tennis racket handy, Cyrus, if you have bats in the area.
And what did he do with the tennis racket?
I think he probably just put it back in the closet. All right, let's go to Janice in Elk River, Minnesota. Hello, Janice.
Patrick Madrid, I love your show.
Oh, thank you.
I do. You and Cyrus make such a great team. What you don't think of, he does. And you're also going to be here. You're going to be in Elk River on Saturday. I am so excited.
I am too. And it's nice to know that you live there. And I'm trying to, I don't have any of that info in front of me. Trying to remember, Elk River, isn't that sort of like northwest of the cities? In that direction?
Correct. That's true. Yes, and we are very excited to have you. We can hardly wait. I'm really excited.
Thank you.
It's going to be such an honor because, like I said, I listen to you guys like 24/7.
Thank you.
You guys are great.
Well, I look forward to meeting you, too.
You have brought so much sunshine to my life. I'm sorry.
No, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was just saying I look forward to meeting you, too, Janice.
Yes, and Father Mark, you're going to love him. He's great. Awesome parish.
Wonderful.
So be kind, be amazing, be you, and we'll see you on Saturday.
Okay, Janice, thank you very much. You're the welcome wagon. I appreciate it very much. Thank you. Let's go to Rhonda in Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi. Hey, my question is this. When I get to heaven, will I be able to hug Jesus? And the reason I ask that is because of the social distancing right now, and when you see these pictures of people finally getting to hug their loved ones, I think I will fall at Jesus' feet. I don't have long enough hair to wipe his feet like the woman did in the Bible, mm-hmm. but I know he's physically, you know, you can do it. He's not a spirit. He's got the same capabilities we do. So is that something I will be able to do?
I think so. I mean, hugging is a natural expression of love that people have. It's hard to know. I mean, in Jesus' public ministry, did people hug him? I'm sure his mother hugged him. I'm sure his father hugged him. Did the apostles hug him? It's hard to know whether Jesus had a sort of reserve about him. I think it would be appealing to many people to imagine that Jesus was a hugger, but maybe he wasn't. I don't know. And when we get to heaven, it's hard to really imagine what it will be like there, but we know that Jesus has a glorified body, and when the end of the world comes and we all receive our glorified bodies back, those are going to heaven anyway, we will experience the joys of heaven in a bodily way. What does that mean, food? What does that mean exactly? I'm not sure. So I guess the best way I could put it, Rhonda, is that if this is part of the perfection of heaven, that we can have that kind of embrace with each other, then yes, we will be able to do that. But if that would be unnecessary or superfluous, then maybe no. And here's why I say that. Jesus said that in heaven there will be no marrying or giving in marriage. Now, let's pause on this for a minute. So we know that in, and parents, if you have little kids listening right now, just turn the radio down for 60 seconds. That's all I ask. Just turn it down for 60 seconds because I'm going to talk about a topic that may not be age appropriate for them. Fair warning, ready, steady, go. Jesus said there'll be no marrying and giving in marriage. Now, in marriage, we know that sexual intimacy is a very important part of marriage. It's not the only thing. It's not even necessarily the most important thing, but it is an important thing, to be sure. And in heaven, we won't have that. So if you think about the beauty and the pleasure and even the joy that couples experience in that way of, for married people, for enjoying that intimacy with each other, and when you consider how important that is to us and how much people are really focused on it, and then imagine that that will not happen at all in heaven, because what we will experience there in terms of intimacy and love with God will be so far superior to sexual intimacy in this life. So when I consider it through that lens, I think that, you know, maybe hugging will be kind of like that. Maybe it will be superfluous because whatever we experience in heaven is going to be so much better than hugging. I hope that makes sense. It's an interesting question, and I guess we'll find out when we get there. Let's go. You know what? We have to take another break. Let's take a break. We'll come right back. We'll do nothing but phone calls until the end of the hour. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forest.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Okay, we are back. Let's go to Maria, listening in Tampa. Hi, Maria.
Hi. I just wanted to call and remark on your data about how many times people look at their iPhone.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to share that I recently had a confession. I had a penance where I had to take a day and do a technology fast. And I mean, primarily the phone is what we were talking about.
Uh-huh.
And I just wanted to encourage, it was a great day. I planned ahead. I said, okay, I'm not going to be checking my phone tomorrow. I checked it a few times just because I have kids at school. And, I was glad I did because one of my kids got done with practice early. So I had to pick her up. But aside from that, I wasn't looking at, you know, the random text that came in from text chains and all that kind of stuff. And it was a great day. And so I just wanted to call and encourage people that if you're looking for something to give up or to try to, either offer it up for someone or to just, implement a good practice for yourself, take a day and establish that you're going to do a tech fast and just let your spouse know so that if they need you, they call.
And they don't get worried.
I'm nervous. I'm running out of breath. So let the essential people know. And my husband actually, he had the same one. And so he uses his phone all the time for business. So he took a Sunday and he just said, all right, as of this time, I'm plugging the entire day. Mm-hmm. And he did, and we both had positive experience. So that was the first thing. The second thing, on the same vein, is I just wanted to encourage parents with like kids and cell phones, and I know oftentimes I kind of fall back on Patrick Madrid says to wait until your kids are 18, and right now my oldest is 14. She just started high school, and so far she doesn't have a cell phone, and she's surviving, and she's having a really good experience, and. Mm-hmm. For all the people who think like it can't be done, like you just can't do it. I mean, so far so good. And we've been close to caving at times, and maybe I'll swallow my words and cave next week. I don't know. But that was the other thing I wanted to say is that it can be done. And it's sparked some good conversations. Just yesterday, she was telling me about this multi-grade text chain and someone was calling out some girl for being a hypocrite. And then a lot of people were jumping on and agreeing, and then the girl said she felt really hurt by the people she thought they were her friends. And I just kind of looked at my daughter and said, you have to admit, like, this wouldn't be happening if there weren't cell phones, mm-hmm. How hurtful to all the people involved. And it was a great conversation, and she hated saying that I was right, but she also knew I was right.
I think this is a good example. What you said is just right. It's, it can be done. And it will be difficult for most of us. I'm sure it would be difficult for me to go without my phone for an extended period of time. But it can be done. And I guess maybe the deeper point here is that it should be done from time to time, at least.
Mm-hmm.
So that you don't become overly dependent upon that technology. Excellent point, Maria. Excellent point. I'm glad you called today. Thank you. Let's go to Kip now in Easton, Pennsylvania. Hello, Kip. Nice to talk to you again.
Hey, Patrick. Nice to talk to you, too. Listen, there were two things that callers called about that I wanted to comment on. First of all, about 2.5 years ago, my brother Pete passed away, and his body was cremated and transferred from where he passed away in Florida to where he was interred in Texas, and they held a mass for him. So the woman who asked about a mass for someone who had been cremated, at least in our situation, a mass was said.
Yeah.
For his repose.
Thanks for pointing that out, because that was my understanding. That is my understanding, that that would not, you know, be a reason to prohibit a mass. So I'm glad that you could confirm that.
No problem. And the other one is a little more in depth. It was the woman who called about the selfishness in her in one of her relations. And I just wanted to offer her an idea that I used in my family that really seemed to work pretty well. You know, we know what love is because we have it in Corinthians. Love is patient, love is kind, and all the rest. But if you look at it, the opposite of love is selfishness, because selfishness is impatient, it's unkind, and all the rest.
Right.
And so if you look at that as the opposite of love is selfishness, and then when you break down selfishness to selfishness, S-I-N.
Yeah.
The opposite of love is sin.
Clever, yeah.
And that, for whatever reason, that struck a chord in my family, and so I just offer that as just another idea that might be helpful.
Very wise, Kip. Very insightful. As you were saying that, I'm reminded of what St. Thomas Aquinas said. He said, and this is a close paraphrase, he said that inordinate self-love is the root cause of every sin. And he was there speaking, I believe, about pride, which is essentially inordinate self-love. And that fits in nicely with what you just said.
Very good.
Well, thank you. I hope things are going well for you in Easton, Pennsylvania.
Thanks, as always, Patrick. Have a great day.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. We've got now Rhonda in Katy, Texas. Good morning, Rhonda.
Good morning. I have a question about St. Paul, Romans 16, verse 11.
All right.
Says, greet my kinsman, Herodian. Now, when I tried, somebody posed this question last evening. So I was trying to find out who Herodian was, and there are different versions online. I can't pull out my Josephus right now because my Staghorn Fern's in front of it. So I thought maybe you would be able to supply me the answer.
Well, here's what I can tell you, two things. One is that when you say Josephus, do you mean Flavius Josephus, the Jewish historian?
Correct.
I'm almost certain that he would not be able to provide any information about this at all, because he didn't write about St. Paul or about the New Testament. You know, he wrote a little bit about Jesus, but he didn't write about St. Paul. So I'm almost certain, I'm about as certain as I can be without being absolutely certain, that you won't find anything in Josephus. Rather, you'll find commentaries, Catholic commentary on Holy Scripture by Dom Bernard Orchard, that's one source, or some of the other Catholic commentaries that are available. But simply put, we don't know who Herodian was. He says, greet my kinsman Herodian, greet those in the Lord who belong to the family of Narcissus. We don't have certitude as to who some of these people who are mentioned in passing are. Maybe some scripture scholars can link them perhaps with other people, but we're just not told who Herodian was. We can presume that he might have been a cousin or a nephew or somehow related to St. Paul. But beyond that, I don't think we know.
Okay. Because there was some reference online that he was a saint. There's another reference that he was a slave that was freed. And the list goes on and on. So it was like nothing concrete. So I figured maybe you could help.
Well, I hate to disappoint, but I think I have to in this case.
That's okay.
Yeah, if you were to get a commentary by, say, Dr. Scott Hahn or the one that I just mentioned by Don Bernard Orchard. I could look that up, but I don't have time to do it while the show's going on right now. But those are ways to find out if scholars have found more detail about it. So that'd be my suggestion, Rhonda. Thank you. And it's great that you're reading your Bible. Let's go to Meg in Fulda, Minnesota. Hello, Meg.
Hey, hi, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Quick question for you. I am involved in an ecumenical Bible study, and we're doing the Gospel of Matthew. And the last verse of Matthew 1 talks about St. Joseph and Mary. And I'm totally in line with Catholic teaching on Joseph's amazing devotion to Mary and the idea that they would never have consummated their marriage physically. Right. But the last verse says something that makes me ponder. It says, he had no relations with her until she bore a son and he named him Jesus.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, the implication is that once Jesus was born, they went on and had a typical marriage. Yeah.
Right. And that is a passage that does trip some people up, so don't feel bad about it. This is, at first glance, it certainly seems to suggest that. But in fact, that's not what it's saying. And I can show you how to demonstrate that to your own satisfaction. So the word that's used there, sometimes you see it as heos, H-E-O-S. Sometimes you see it as heos hu. So H-E-O-S, second part of the word would be H-U. But it means until. And they're synonymous. So whichever form you see it in, it means exactly the same thing. And it doesn't mean, as it does in modern 21st century American English, or it doesn't have the connotation necessarily as it does in modern 21st century American English, that that the status of the situation changed after the event in question. So when you and I read that in English and it says he did not know her until she brought forth her firstborn son, the implication is, in modern 21st century American English, that after she had her firstborn son, then this activity took place. But here's how you can demonstrate that it didn't take place. So if you go, for example, to 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 23. Now, originally this was written in Hebrew, but if you consider the Septuagint Greek version, you see the same construction there, the same heos, as it sometimes heos who in other places. And there we see the story of King David, who was rejoicing when the Ark of the Lord was brought back after being recaptured from the Philistines, who had captured it in battle. And King David was dancing with joy, and his wife, Michal, the daughter of Saul, she was irritated by this because he was a little too, shall we say, exposed to the ladies who were watching, and she didn't like that. So the very end of that passage says that after this had happened, that Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no more children until the day of her death. And that same heos appears there. Now, obviously, she didn't have any children after the day of her death. It's just saying that between the time that this happened and when Michal died, that she and King David did not do what was necessary for a child to be conceived. And so it's just simply making that point. It's not saying that anything happened after that. Another example of that is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 25. And this, I think, is another way of really demonstrating from the New Testament that this heos hu is not really, it's not really suggesting a change. And this is where it says, for he, referring to Christ, he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. And there it is again, heos. Now, this doesn't mean that after Jesus puts all his enemies under his feet that he ceases to reign. Obviously, he will reign forever because he's the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. So if you were to do a word study, as I have and others have, what you'll find is that although in some cases the status does change after the word until, but in many cases it does not. So you could say, Grandma didn't take her medicine until she died. Well, she didn't take her medicine after she died. It just means that she didn't take her medicine before she died. So with that in mind, what is being said in Matthew chapter 1 is simply, it's simply asserting the fact that there was no human father involved in the conception of Jesus. And that's all it's saying. It's not extending to anything that took place after that. Now, there's a great deal of biblical information that implicitly shows us that Mary was a perpetual virgin. And unfortunately, I don't have time to unravel that for you just because we have to leave in a minute. But if you call another time, I'd be happy to offer you a fuller explanation of how we can defend Mary's perpetual virginity. But at the very least, we know that this verse does not say that she was not a perpetual virgin. And one other little tidbit for you, Meg. Back in the, back in the 4th century, there was a fellow by the name of Helvidius who wrote an article, a tract, asserting that Mary had other children besides Jesus. And the great Saint Jerome, who was a master of Greek and Hebrew and Latin, he went after Helvidius with his own tract, which was written called Against Helvidius. And this is one of the very verses that Helvidius used to try to say that Mary had other children. And St. Jerome took him apart like a cheap watch. So it's interesting to see that this question has been around an awfully long time. So don't feel like, sure. You know, there's any reason to be concerned about it. Does that help?
That does help a lot. I appreciate the information, and I'll go forth knowing I love the Catholic teaching on Joseph, and it's beautiful. So thank you.
I agree. It is beautiful. Well, you're welcome, Meg, and thank you for calling. It's a nice high note to finish up on, and until we're together again, I'll be praying for you. Please pray for me. God bless you. Cyrus, you were right and I was wrong.